Well, good afternoon to all of you, many old dear friends, and those of you that I don't know. It's always good to come back and visit a congregation you pastored and to look around and see faces that you don't recognize. In fact, it's one of the components to visiting that you truly appreciate. As Steve was up here trying to figure out, I wasn't sure whether he was asking how long we'd been here or when we left. Diane and I had the joy, I put that in quotes, of departing Seattle the week of Y2K. What a lovely time to move. We were sitting in extended stay America in Portland on January the 1st, 2000. Having been told to move down to Portland in November, in fact, we were commuting down to Portland during the month of November. Following the feast, Mr. Dean Blackall had been diagnosed with Parkinson's, and we began to commute from here to take his spot. And then house hunt at the same time, and eventually the last week in December, pack our trailer, go on down, and start assuming duties there. So time has flown. It's been 5 years. It's nice to come back up. It's especially delightful that we get the opportunity, Diane and I, to spend a social evening with you, a social afternoon, potluck, and to commemorate two lovely new marriages. So bonus all the way around. The only thing I regret is Mr. Luker's not here. Diane and I and Denny and Leanne thoroughly enjoy one another company-wise, and it's always fun to get together, but this time it doesn't work out that way. Mr. Luker did want me to say that the Portland Northwest Weekend, he said, be sure and let everyone know, the Portland Northwest Weekend is on again this year, as it has been for the last 25. It will be on the Christmas weekend. We'll have seminars for young adults. We'll have volleyball games, a teen dance on Saturday evening, special services Saturday afternoon. We'll be sending you all the details relatively soon, but just wanted to let you know that all of it is in process. We've got a couple of more details before we send out the flyer, and it'll be the Christmas weekend, December, I think, 25th, 26th, 27th, Saturday, Sunday, and for the young adults, even seminars on Monday. I'd like to talk to you this afternoon about encouragement. Encouragement's an interesting word in terms of what it sparks in the mind. I think most of us, when we think of encouragement, we think of a letter, a Hallmark card, a telephone call, a pat on the back, kind words spoken, and all of those are encouragement. But in its truest, fullest sense, encouragement means to give to someone else courage. You know, you lift somebody's heart with kind words. A card in times of stress and difficulty do the same. These are forms of encouragement, but they're very minor forms of encouragement compared to what the fullness of the term means. It means to take someone who has lost it or has never had it and to give to them courage. A year ago, Mr. Clyde Kylo and I were in Cincinnati dealing with some council business, and after a full day, he looked at me and I looked at him and said, you know, we need to wind down this evening. And said, well, what are we going to do after we eat? And so the movie theater not far from the home office had a new film, and we said, let's go. We spent the evening, enjoyed the film so much that the next day, when it was time to get on the plane, I stopped at the bookstore in Cincinnati Airport, found the book, and spent the entire flight home reading the book. The book is one of the classic all-time American stories of giving courage. Most of you, if not all of you, are familiar with either the movie or the book. The title was Seabiscuit. Talking about a horse that became one of the greatest racehorses in American history, and yet a horse at its 2-year mark had reached the place where those who evaluate racehorses had said, this horse is really worth virtually nothing except to serve as a saddle horse. How, at that juncture, did that horse reach the place of becoming one of the finest racehorses in all of American history? The answer to the question is a study in encouragement. It is interesting, brethren, that whether you encourage beast or man, the qualities that allow you to give courage are really not that different. The fact that Seabiscuit was a horse, and by our definition, one of the dumb beasts, doesn't change the fact that the technology and the tools that were used to encourage this animal apply equally in the encouragement of human beings. Seabiscuit has gone down in history as one of the finest horses in the world of horse racing. As I said a moment ago, as a three-year-old, the 3 years of age put him in the two-year-old bracket racing-wise. At 3 years old, he was sold for a pittance, auctioned off, really didn't get much, and he was bought with the consideration that he probably was not worth anything as a racehorse, and from that time on would be nothing more than a saddle horse. The irony of it was that Seabiscuit had been in the stable of the greatest trainer of that day. You know, there are some times where even some of the most skilled people can discourage. James Fitzsimmons, previous trainer for Seabiscuit, had trained two of the first three Triple Crown winners. The greatest achievement in racehorse racing, is to win the Triple Crown. And this gentleman had the distinction of having already trained two out of the first three winners. And yet in Seabiscuit, he didn't see potential. In Seabiscuit, he didn't have the capacity to see through the obstacles into the spirit and the heart. What went wrong? And what was done to correct it? I'd like you to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 16, where there is here in the selection of David as the next king of Israel, as it were, a spiritual axiom. Samuel has been sent to find Saul's successor, and as he arrives at David's home, he's looking at all of David's older brothers and says, this has got to be the one. This is a phenomenal specimen. God says, no. He looks at the next brother and he says, well, this has got to be the one. He's not a bad-looking fellow either. He says, no, that's not the one. And as we walk through 1 Samuel chapter 16, Samuel went through all of the sons of Jesse from the oldest on down, in essence saying, God, this is the one. God saying, no. Well, God, this is the one. No, that's not the one. Well, God, that must be the one. Well, no, that's not the one. When he'd exhausted everything and he'd gotten down to the youngest of Jesse's sons, God says, that's the one. And he then said something to Samuel that is proverbial. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7, this is what God said to Samuel. He said to Samuel, he said, don't look at the appearance. Don't look at the height. Don't look at the stature. Because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So as Samuel walked through this exercise in selecting the next king of Israel, God said to him, you know, Samuel, you can look somebody over on the surface and you look at their impressiveness, their size, their stature, their presence, their dynamics, their voice, all of these qualities. He said, that's not where it's at. He said, that's not the measure of a person. The measure of a person is their heart. Seabiscuit, from the standpoint of what we just read, would never have been chosen as a great racehorse. I'm going to read excerpts every so often through the book Seabiscuit just to help you understand. Seabiscuit was a descendant of the mighty man of war, probably the greatest racehorse in American history. Through his sire, the brilliantly fast, exceptionally handsome Hardtack. But his stunted build reflected none of the beauty and breadth of his forebears. The colt's body, built low to the ground, had all the properties of a cinder block. I'm not a horseman. Never spent a great deal of time around horses. Have no claim to understanding horses. And yet I can look at a picture of Man o' War, and I can look at a picture of Seabiscuit, and even with the little knowledge I have, shake my head and say, where on earth did Seabiscuit come from? He had a straddle-legged gait that was so awkward that he looked like an egg beater. His gallop was so disorganized that he had a maddening tendency to whack himself in the front ankle with his own hind hoof. One observer compared his action to a duck waddle. All of this raggedness was not helped by his racing schedule, and it went on to describe that aspect. Seabiscuit is a horse. When you looked at horse flesh, you simply looked at the beast and said, this is a disaster. And then you looked at him run and you said, now I know it's a disaster. It was probably in part that Fitzsimmons removed Seabiscuit from his stable on that basis. When he was picked up by his next trainer, Tom Smith, he was at the very bottom. Broken in spirit, ragged, emotionally raw, angry, rebellious, there wasn't a quality in Seabiscuit that was redeeming. And yet Tom Smith, when he inherited the animal, had the feeling that maybe he could do something with him. What would you do to build back what had been taken away? Even more importantly, how do you give courage to go beyond anything ever experienced? Because the story of Seabiscuit isn't about coming back to zero. It is about passing zero on the upthrust and going to full potential. Let me give you a starting place. It's found in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. In Ecclesiastes chapter 4, Solomon wrote, beginning in verse 7, he said, then I returned and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Tom Smith, the trainer who had the task of rebuilding Seabiscuit, understood this particular reality. Horses are social creatures, just like human beings. They're not meant to be alone. Their instinct is not to be alone. They don't thrive alone. And so just like human beings, and the comment that Solomon made about us, they're not designed or built to be by themselves. And Tom Smith said, the first thing that I need to do is provide companionship. As I said, Seabiscuit was ragged, really raw and ragged. I might ask, how many of you had the chance to see the movie Seabiscuit? Good. The movie and the book have very little in common. I don't mean that in the sense that the facts are different. It's just the book is far, far more thorough than the book. The book would have shown you what took place when Tom Smith decided it was time to try to help Seabiscuit, because one of the humorous incidents as they left in was when he brought a goat to share quarters with Seabiscuit, and Seabiscuit unceremoniously picked up the goat by the nape of the neck and threw him over the top of the stable door, putting an end to that friendship. There was down at the other end of the stable, though, a very gentle, large, older horse, very even temperament, named Punkin. And he brought Punkin down from the other side of the stable, brought Punkin up to Seabiscuit's stall. They sniffed each other, and there was a level of acceptance that allowed Punkin to move in to the stall next door. They took the wall down between the two stalls, so there was simply a barrier between them, but they could see each other and they could spend the time together. The experiment with Punkin worked so well that Smith began collecting other stable companions for Seabiscuit. Now, if any of you have ever spent any time around a thoroughbred stable, you know that it's really not uncommon at all for thoroughbred racehorses to have companions, and for that companion to look rather strange, considering that this is a stable and these are horses. Somewhere along the way, a little spotted gray dog fell in with the Howard barn and began to travel with it. Named Pocatel, the dog had curiously upright ears that were round as platters and roughly three times normal size. Pocatel took a liking to Seabiscuit and began sleeping in his stall at night. Jojo, a small spider monkey of undetermined origin, had the same preference for Seabiscuit's company. Sleeping with Punkin a few feet away, Jojo in the crook of his neck and Pocatel on his belly, Seabiscuit began to relax. The trainer realized one of the first things that needed to be done to restore courage, to restore hope, to restore sanity, to restore reason in this beleaguered beast was to provide for it friends, companions, those who could be around him, those with whom he could feel comfort, those that would allow him to have someone to diffuse the frustration and the anger that was only built by solidarity. We don't often think about these particular things in the light of building encouragement among those who are discouraged, but the sense of it rings true, doesn't it? After having provided Seabiscuit with companions, one of the next things that he did was to begin to refine his diet. You and I live in a world where the state of the mind and the state of the body are looked at as detached. Now, it doesn't mean all of you do by any means. But you know what? Our state of mind and our state of health are not detached. Those who are concerned about being extraordinary in the field of athletics are probably those who are most inclined to take extremely good care of their bodies physically. Those who really care little about themselves often really care little about their diet. Tom Smith said, "Now that I can see a calming beginning to take place through companionship, I need also to restore the health of the animal internally." You know, it's an old book. It's been many years since it was printed, and I have no idea if any of you have looked at it in some time, but the old booklet, The Seven Laws of Success. If you go back and read it again, and they were placed in a priority order. If you read it, you will note that the order was deliberate. The third of the laws of success was good health, listed right behind having a goal and getting the necessary education. So in priority order, having a goal and then having the necessary education to be able to qualify you to pursue that goal was good health. I mentioned to you that we could use an animal to learn lessons about human beings. Well, that shoe fits both ways. Tom Smith, as he was looking at Seabiscuit's diet, observed the University of Washington rowing team and the regimen that they had been put on dietarily to provide them the strength and the endurance to be able to row, which involved a level of calcium in their diet which was above normal. And he said, if it's good for them, it's good for Seabiscuit. He looked around the country, and in Northern California, there was a type of hay due to the soil that had nutrients that were exceptional. That hay and that hay alone was fed to Seabiscuit along with the other dietary supplements to help to rebuild a body that had really been beaten down. Seabiscuit, as I'll read to you in a moment, was ridden hard. As the old horseman's statement goes, he was ridden hard and put up wet. Now, he wasn't literally put up wet, but he was ridden, and he was ridden, and he was ridden. He was given no break. He was given no mercy. Racehorses are like pitchers in the major leagues. You have only so often that you pitch in order to pitch at optimum. Racehorses only race so often if they're going to perform at optimum. Seabiscuit was simply a run every time there was a race. And the amount of time between made no difference. You see, the trainer had seen in him what he considered to be a stubborn and a rebellious attitude, and he said, I'll break it. And one of the tools he saw fit to use to break it was simply, I'll run him until he can't stand up. And so when Tom Smith inherited Seabiscuit, he was badly in need of dietary repair along with everything else. You're all familiar. I don't need to turn back there. You're all familiar with Daniel chapter 1, verses 5 through 16. Now, I'll just give you the scriptural rendering, because this is the place where the king of Babylon takes a select group of young men to train them to become individuals in the court of the king of Babylon. And he says to the steward, I want them fed the best. And Daniel says to the steward, he says, you know, Daniel's diplomatic, but the message is what the king thinks is the best is not the best, and I would prefer to eat what I know is better. And the steward says, you know what, if I bring you in at the end of this period and you don't look absolutely radiantly healthy, I lose my head. So this isn't a matter of preference, this is a matter of my life. And Daniel, out of respect for that, said, well, give me a brief period on my diet and you judge how I look, and then if I don't pass muster, then we can change to the diet that you've prescribed. And if you read the account there, when the steward comes back, he says, you look fine, your diet's been good for you, you look fit, you look healthy, I'm not in jeopardy, eat your diet. Seems far too simple, but you know, the foundation for encouragement was the provision of good friends and a good diet to rebuild both the body and the emotions. Anyone who works in a school system realizes that one of the challenges in America today is the fact that there are children who come to school so badly nourished that there are breakfast programs in public schools, realizing the very thing we're talking about. We have children coming to school so badly fed and badly nourished that they can't give the proper attention to the classwork. And so the institution of programs that feed them on the front end before classes is to simply acknowledge the same reality. You can sit there and say, well, why don't you pay attention? Why aren't you learning? What's wrong? In some cases, it's simply a matter of, I'm not properly fed. How do you deal with the damage done by long-term discouragement? When you see a person who has entered the self-destruct mode, do you ever stop to consider that what you're seeing may be the results of long-term discouragement. If you were to take upon yourself the task of encouraging, literally restoring the courage of one deeply discouraged, you must not just see the person in order to encourage. You must also understand why the person is where they are in order to encourage. Those conditioned by long-term discouragement inflicted upon them by others, if they don't simply give up and quit, because that's one option, if they don't simply give up and quit, in other words, you haven't taken the fire out of me, they learn to rebel. They learn to fight back in whatever way they can. Seabiscuit was of the variety that was described by the latter. He didn't give up and quit. He learned how to rebel. He learned how to fight back. He learned how to defy. I'll read you a couple of for instances. Talking about his trainer, it says, Smith knew what he was seeing, talking about watching the horse perform. Seabiscuit's competitive instincts had been turned backward. Instead of directing his efforts against his opponents, he was directing them against the handlers who tried to force him to run. He habitually met every command with resistance. He was feeding off the fight, gaining satisfaction from the distress and rage of the man on his back. If the jockey pulled right, he went left. If the jockey whipped him to go, he stopped. Whatever it was the jockey tried to get him to do, he did just the opposite. He absolutely infuriated the jockeys who tried to ride him. He was so mean-tempered that anyone that even came close to his stable door, within reach, got a sound nip, if he could reach them. As Smith watched the competitive instincts, he said they've all gone haywire. They've all been turned around. They've all been misdirected. Inherent in a thoroughbred. I'll give you a for instance. All of you have seen a sheepdog work, an Australian sheepdog as an illustration. It's bred into them to herd sheep. You don't have to say, now let me teach you. From a pup onward, they are genetically geared so that when they see sheep, they herd. Racehorses genetically love to run. You don't have to teach them to run. You don't have to say, well, let's see if we can get you to like running. Running is what they are. Running is what they do. It isn't taught. It's inherent. Seabiscuit had reached the place where he said, the last thing I'm going to do is run. I'll give you every bit of grief I can and every way I can, but one thing you won't get from me, I will not run for you. And so Smith was looking at the product of long-term discouragement. You know, there's a wise saying that revolves around parenting. And it's a wise saying about parenting when your children reach the place where they have become young men and young women, and they start having minds of their own, and they start seeing the future, and they start seeing that out beyond them is leaving the nest and becoming their own person, self-sufficient, self-supporting, self-sustaining. The child-rearing statement says simply, if you want to keep them, let them go. There's a point in time where teaching your children how to leave the nest is the greatest service you can do, and trying to keep a short leash on them and keep them in the nest is going to get for you grief untold. Seabiscuit was living in the same type of world. You can't force feed encouragement. It comes in some cases by removing the cause of discouragement. It comes at times by taking the need to fight, the fight of resistance, out of the equation. Elijah the prophet in 1 Kings chapter 19 had been a phenomenal prophet. He had just gone through one of the grandest events in all of biblical history, a one-man resistance to the entirety of the priests of Baal. He had stood up while the priests of Baal had flagellated themselves, had danced, had chanted, had begged, had pleaded, had prayed for Baal to respect their offerings. And Elijah, with a simple prayer, after having absolutely drowned an offering and an altar to where there was a filled moat around it, made a simple prayer to God, and fire came down from heaven and consumed the offering and all the rocks that made up the altar and left nothing. By the next day, following one of the greatest demonstrations of God's power in support of someone, Elijah was running full bore past the "you are now leaving Israel, come back and see us" sign, ran all the way through Judah, past the "you are now leaving Judah" sign, entered the wilderness, ran halfway across the wilderness, found a cave, crawled into it, and said, "I simply want to sit here and die." Reading 1 Kings chapter 19 is a lesson directly from God in dealing with the discouraged. Elijah said, "I've given it my best. I've done everything I could. I've been faithful. I've been loyal. There's nobody left. I'm the only one. We've lost. Jezebel has won. I just want to lay down and die." God came to the cave in the wilderness where Elijah was sitting. And he gave him a display. Verse 9 it says, "And there he went into the cave and spent the night in that place. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him and said to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' And he said, 'I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life.' And then he said, 'Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord.' And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore into the mountains and broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a delicate, whispering voice." And so it was when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And suddenly a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he repeats what we read earlier. What did the Lord say to him? Ream him out? Breathe fire on him? Slap him all over the place? Well, we had already seen how he approached him. The margin of verse 12 says, "a delicate, whispering voice." There's no correction in what God says. There's no reprimand. There's no scorn. There's no ridicule. The Lord said to him, "Go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria. Also you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel, And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. And it shall be that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill, and whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. And oh, by the way, Elijah, there are still 7,000 back home who haven't given up the fight. That's encouragement. As I ask you, what do you do with somebody who's beaten down by discouragement? God's approach to a totally discouraged Elijah in the cave provides a wonderful example of how to encourage. Little things add up. Everybody likes a dramatic story. They like the one attempt and the grand success, the opportunity to get in there, give it your best, and boom, all of a sudden you've got the product. But you know, encouragement doesn't usually work that way. Encouragement requires from the one giving it a durability and a consistency to hang in there as somebody comes out of the state of discouragement and eventually moves the opposite direction. From the time Seabiscuit began to race until Tom Smith bought him, he was ridden hard, he was whipped in every race, and he was raced with no rest. As I said earlier, he learned to resist with all the fierceness of his spirit the maltreatment that was given to him. When you instinctively have reached the place that every action gets an opposite reaction, somebody wants something positive out of you, but you have learned that whatever you do to me, I am going to react in a way that is counter to where you want me to go. Where do you start? Sometimes some of the littlest things. Sometimes things that are little in the way that the one who is being encouraged doesn't even recognize them at the time they're occurring. Discipline was introduced into Seabiscuit's way of life in a way that didn't even seem to be discipline. This was a horse, when the jockey got on it, as I said earlier, if he pulled right, he went left. If he urged him forward, he stopped. He went through fences, madly across the infield. He did all sorts of insane things. Tom Smith said, "Put the whip away." He also told the jockey, "Get on, hang on, and let him go where he wants to go." For a while, Seabiscuit had to come to the place of realizing that there wasn't somebody trying to force him. Long enough to realize, okay, this is different. I don't know what it is, I don't know where it's going, but it's different. As they maneuvered their way through this movement from total rebellion to all actions to some degree of sanity, one of the subtle things the trainer did on every workout was to end the workout at the finish line. A subtlety. A subtlety in trying to restore an animal so that animal began to think in terms of, when I end, this is where I end. No command, no action, just simply the fact that every day's workout ended at the finish line. An investment in the future. He wasn't ready to race. He wasn't even remotely ready to go there. It was an investment in the future. It was that kind of subtle training that is not seen, nor understood, nor comprehended at the time, but begins to play into the whole. I think all of us know from friends who have been discouraged that there are some components of encouragement that can come into play only after a degree of relationship has been built. You can't force encouragement on anyone. You can't come waltzing in saying, "Well, I got the formula, I've got the skill, I've got the know-how, I know how it's done, let's go after it." There's somebody on the receiving end, and whoever it is on the receiving end has to feel there's enough of a relationship there that we're going to interact with one another. Consistent, calm discipline is vital to building courage in another. Yet it can only come after a solid relationship of trust has been built. I use the word discipline, and I hope that doesn't raise a flag, because we're not talking about chastisement. We're simply talking about structure. The more dysfunctional a person's life, the more chaotic their life. For any of you who have dealt with dysfunction, people who are highly dysfunctional, one of the greatest earmarks of dysfunction is chaos. So the term discipline is used in the sense of recreating order and structure and sensibility to a life that has been chaotic. All right? As I said, I realize when the word discipline is used, it can take you different ways. Consistent, calm, structured existence. Tom Smith gave Seabiscuit time to learn to trust him and his jockey. He said, "We're in no hurry. The first thing that we have to do is we have to restore trust. And if there is no trust, then we're not going anywhere." One of the excerpts at this particular point reads as follows. Smith gave Seabiscuit time to learn to trust him and Pollard, his jockey. Seabiscuit learned. When he heard Pollard's deep voice coming down the shed row, he'd poke his head over the half door to greet him. When Pollard, who called the horse Pops, sat outside the stall reading the paper while Seabiscuit was cooled out, the horse would tug his hot walker off course to snuffle his jockey's hand. So as the fellow who walked the horse after he'd been racing to give him time to cool down, if they walked by Pollard, he'd yank the walker over and he'd snuff at Pollard. When Smith led him out of the stall, he didn't even need a lead rope. The horse would follow his trainer wherever he went, nuzzling his pockets. Smith spoke to the horse in nearly inaudible tones, calling him son and touching him lightly when he needed him to turn. Seabiscuit understood him and did as he asked. In moments of uncertainty, the horse would pause and look for Smith. When he found his trainer, the horse relaxed. Smith taught him that he could trust his trainer and rider, and this became the foundation for the trials the three would share over the next 5 years. Smith let horses get confidence in him, remembered Keith Sturkey, one of the horse's exercise riders. He was the best horseman I've ever seen. With long, careful schooling, Seabiscuit began to figure things out. Once he was no longer being coerced, his instincts bubbled back to the surface. His innate love of running returned. Pollard used the whip not as an implement of force, but as a signal. One glancing swat on the rump at the eighth pole, another a few feet from home, a cue that it was time to hustle. Seabiscuit began to wait for it and respond with lightning quickness. "So long as you treat him like a gentleman," said Pollard, "he'll run his heart out for you." That didn't come quickly. It came over time. It came with consistency. It came by the investment of small things. It came by giving a beleaguered animal friends. It came by restoring its physical health. It came by helping it understand that those things against which it kicked and rebelled were simply not a part of the relationship that was going to exist in this new experience. And as time went by, trust took the place of suspicion. A desire to perform took the place of stubbornness. A fondness took the place of contempt and hatred. And an animal began to respond with a spirit that had been encouraged. The spirit that had been beaten out of Seabiscuit was gradually restored. Even better, with the constant encouragement of his trainer, a true courage began to form, leading a beaten, formerly discouraged, rebellious creature to become, as we gave you just a little bit of a window to see, a kind, a gentle being in spirit, and yet focused and determined to excel. All of the qualities that had made Seabiscuit a total disaster to James Fitzsimmons, causing the greatest stable of that day to sell him as basically racehorse refuse. Somebody needs a saddle horse, here it is. I know his grandfather's a man of war. I know his father's hardtack. But this horse is useless. Take him. Tom Smith took the time, the effort, the energy to rebuild. Consider the animal that was introduced to you at the beginning. And I'd like to read to you, because at that particular time I told you fundamentally what he was like. It said his stubby legs were a study in unsound construction with squarish, asymmetrical baseball glove knees that didn't quite straighten all the way, leaving him in a permanent semi-crouch. Thanks to his unfortunate assembly, he walked with an odd straddle-legged motion that was often mistaken for lameness. Asked to run, he would drop low over the track and fall into a comical version of what horsemen called the egg-beater gait, making a spastic sideways flailing motion with his left foreleg as he swung it forward, as if he were swatting flies. That's part that I didn't read, along with the fact that he was actually kicking his own front legs with his back legs. Obviously, when you see the elegance of a true thoroughbred and you see a beast like this standing beside it, you can write him off. Seabiscuit proved that heart and spirit were of tremendous value. Nothing about his exterior said thoroughbred. Despite his bloodline, he'd gotten all the wrong genes. It turned out, though, after Seabiscuit began to win races instead of lose them, because under Fitzsimmons, at the peak of his discouragement, Fitzsimmons ran Seabiscuit in 16 races, and Seabiscuit did Fitzsimmons the courtesy of losing all 16. As a in-your-face. As Seabiscuit began to win races and win them so soundly with speeds that were record-breaking, the owner wanted the one grand match race of that time against another horse of his same bloodline, War Admiral. War Admiral was as beautiful as Seabiscuit was homely. He was as elegant as Seabiscuit was clumsy. He had won the Horse of the Year award multiple times. He was an absolutely beautiful and brilliant racehorse. In fact, so much so that until Seabiscuit had developed such reputation that it could not be ignored, the owner simply said, there will be no race between these two horses. The match race between Seabiscuit and War Admiral was run on the East Coast, War Admiral's home. Seabiscuit was from California. On War Admiral's track and at War Admiral's distance. They ran a mile and 3/16. In that race, War Admiral ran the mile and 3/16 faster, and this was the greatest horse of his time. In the match race against Seabiscuit, War Admiral ran the mile and 3/16 faster than at any time in his entire life. Seabiscuit ran it faster than any horse had ever run it at Pimlico during the thousands of races that had been run on that track since the Civil War. He walked away from War Admiral, beating the greatest horse of that time by 4 lengths, demonstrating the reality that you can take anything discouraged, and with the will, and with the time, and with the spirit, grant it courage.